Everybody bends a knee to Bitcoin eventually. Jamie Dimon's knee is about halfway to the ground. If he was actually opposed to it in any meaningful way, it wouldn't be happening. But he can read the writing on the wall to say, like, look, I may not like it, but I can't be opposed to it because that is the way that things are going.
Watch what they do, not what they say, A. And B, any way that Wall Street sees significant demand and that they can make significant fees, they're going to jump in.
Is the whole world moving towards Bitcoin and Bitcoin only?
Yes, moving towards. I mean, we're not there yet. Supporting another token out there and actually doing it in a way that brings people close to their collateral is much more difficult outside of Bitcoin.
I can't even count the number of times that you hear Bitcoin is pristine collateral. I've never heard anyone say Ethereum is pristine collateral.
Do you think that in the next year or two, the United States is actually going to begin working towards that accumulation of a million Bitcoin? Welcome to the Bitcoin Playbook, where we discuss proven strategies for using Bitcoin in your business. I'm your host, Josh Friedman, and today for this roundup episode, we have Trey Sellers from Unchained and Joe Yanni from Linkster joining. We discuss Jamie Dimon and JP Morgan bending the knee to Bitcoin, a lending company going Bitcoin only, and our predictions for the Bitcoin conference. We recorded this before the conference started, and it's being launched just after it's finishing up, so see how accurate our predictions were. Here are Joe and Trey. All right, guys, welcome back to another roundup episode. This week, we're going to be talking about some headlines in the news as well as Bitcoin price and maybe some predictions for the Bitcoin conference that has not yet happened as of this recording, but will have just wrapped up when this goes live. So, Trey, I wanted to start off with you. You went to Steak and Shake. We talked about that in our last conversation. You actually experienced it, paid in Lightning. What was your experience? How did it go?
The experience was great. Rolled up. Walked in, the place was clean. They, as part of their refresh for the business, even prior, I think, to them adopting tallow for, you know, their cooking oil and then this Bitcoin thing, they have kind of revamped the business to be much less operationally intensive in terms of headcount and that kind of thing. So that was immediately apparent when I walked in. They have these kiosks, which are basically big iPads, and you walk up and you go through putting in your order. When I first walked in the door, there was a big Bitcoin sign on there, you know, now accepting Bitcoin or whatever it said. And then, you know, you walk up, you put in your order. And then when you get to the payment part of that process, it's how do you want to pay? Do you want to pay with a credit card? Do you want to pay with a debit card or whatever it is? And then at the bottom was pay with Bitcoin. You click on that button and it takes you to a QR code that you can scan. I paid with Lightning. I paid with sats from my own Lightning node that's running at home, connected via Zeus wallet. So this is a little advanced for most people who are doing some of this stuff. I still have this Lightning node running, even though I don't use it all that much. But I wanted to just like prove the point that I could pay for my burger and fries with sats that are sovereignly controlled on a node that I control and keys that I control and all of that, and wasn't going through like a middleman or a service of any kind there. So sovereign burger, sovereign fries. And then we sat down and we had our meal and it was great. Like, it was legitimately good. The burger was good. The fries were incredible. I scarfed it all down, soup, and like just vacuumed it up. It was very, very good. So it's, I'm not just blowing smoke. I'm not just saying that just because like I want this Bitcoin thing that they're doing to be successful. I really hope it is. I'm cautiously optimistic because I think that the flavor with which they've launched all of this feels like it's coming from the right place as opposed to just a marketing stunt, but I could be wrong on that. We will see. We will find out, you know, within due time. But I will be back. It was good food. The experience was good. The restaurant was clean. The cooks behind the counter who were cooking all the food, like they were very nice and helpful. It was a good experience. So I know there's been maybe some mishaps across the country at some of the other locations, but my experience was nothing short of flawless.
So I've got to ask, are you going to pay in sats in the future? And that was like kind of a novelty experience. Are you going to continue paying sats where you can? Yeah.
100%. Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm a very strong believer that we should be paying in sats. I do not at all buy into, you should spend your fiat and, HODL your sats. That Bitcoin is money. You should use it as money where it's accepted. You should push forward this integration and encourage the integration that these businesses are doing. You know, it's not easy for them to come up and do that. And as an orange-blooded American, you know, Bitcoiner, like, you should be supporting that. And just, you know, secondarily, like, I totally reject this idea of don't ever spend your sats because you're leaving so much opportunity cost on the table. There's opportunity cost anytime you spend. It's not just spending your Bitcoin. Any dollars that you've spent are sats that could have been stacked. So don't delude yourself into pretending like you're doing some kind of like noble act by hodling your Bitcoin. Just spend it and replace it. Like, that's what you should be doing.
So my experience was a little bit different. The one Steak and Shake in the Jackson, Mississippi area actually had an issue. So none of us local Bitcoiners have been able to pay sats for Steak and Shake yet. That said, they are going to be getting some additional business in the coming days. Joe, I know that you don't have Steak and Shake in your area, but how do you approach the use of Bitcoin paying for things? Do you seek that out? Like, if the opportunity arises, do you pay in Bitcoin? Trey has certainly created a strong line in the sand. Do you line up with his perspective here?
Yeah, maybe not as passionately as Trey, but I certainly respect it. And I do try to find ways to, you know, tinker with new wallets, you know, experiment with Lightning different ways. And, you know, just to piggyback on Trey's general idea, though, of that, I agree with. And something that I do is I do not preach you only acquire the amount of Bitcoin you'll never have to touch. I think this is actually very harmful to someone's acquisition or accumulation process, because they look at it as, okay, this is 1% of my assets, and who knows, maybe it might be worth something someday. Whereas if you look at it like this is a liquid asset, long term, you need to be thinking about this in terms of accumulation. You know, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years from now, you want to have more Bitcoin than you do today, of course. But that opens up the door for someone to, instead of have 1% or 2% of their assets, maybe they have 10 or 20 or 30. And they know 2 years from now, I'm going to sell a little bit of Bitcoin for my daughter's wedding, whatever it may be. You know, they're much more better off looking at it as a liquid asset. That's a long-term game, but it's always right there for you to live your life as you need to.
That's a great thought. And I think that there are a lot more people who are having to think through, do I spend my sats or not? I love the fact that there is now an opportunity to actually have that conversation. You always, almost always been able to find somewhere to spend your sats. But I'm excited about the fact that there are more and more places like that. I love what Steak and Shake has done. I hope there are more who follow suit. But, you know, to the point of the opportunity cost conversation, you know, we've just seen this massive run up in Bitcoin to new all-time highs. I actually know some people who purchased their first Bitcoin when it had a 7 handle like a month ago. And here we are, 109, 110, 111. Who knows where we'll be next week. But what are your thoughts here? Is this the start of a long run? Are we part of, are we still in a 4-year cycle? Is this going to just go up forever? What are your thoughts here?
Well, just one quick comment on the previous discussion before we move on, which is, like, you're absolutely right. Like, imagine Steak and Shake launched this thing and then literally nobody showed up because we're all too high and mighty to spend our sats and then replace them or whatever. Like, what signal does that send to any other businesses that might be thinking about putting Bitcoin on their balance sheet or accepting it in payment of their goods and services? So just like, Put your hubris aside, your HODL hubris aside, and go out and spend your sats, man. It feels good. Feels good. In terms of the price, like, I kind of feel bad for those people who like catch the little bottom there and then go on a 40% run or whatever it is from 70 to 110%, because, man, it just feels too good to be true. And it really is. And sometimes, like, when you catch it just at the right time as your first stacking opportunity, it feels too easy. And then it's too easy to get shaken out a little bit later when you haven't like really developed a conviction. It's almost better if you buy it near the top and then endure
that
the pain up front,
you know. 48 so, to 16 for me.
I don't know. I feel like I've bought Bitcoin all over the place and endured all kinds of drawdowns over the, you know, last 8 years or whatever that I've been in Bitcoin. But I think from a price standpoint, we I kind of predicted, I think this was on a spaces on X several weeks ago, that it looks likely we're going to go to the new highs. And then I predicted, I expect a little bit of a pullback or consolidation from there, like maybe down into the $90,000 to $95,000 range, just because it's like looking at the price structure and challenging this new high after such a big drawdown is not typically what happens. Typically you meet some supply there and you've got to work through that level in order for the price to go higher. So I'm going to hold to that prediction. I think, you know, at the most bullish thing that we could see is that we kind of chop around here, unless we just break out. But like, short of that, the most bullish that we could see is that we kind of chop around here between the 110 and the 100 for the next few weeks or whatever, and then start continuing higher. I still think I expect that we're going to continue to consolidate maybe through the rest of the summer before a big Q3 and Q4 rally that takes us, you know, north of 250,000.
Love it. I just want to take a quick moment to just pause and appreciate this moment with you guys. We are slowly crawled our way back up to all-time highs. We're easing our way into price discovery. There's no froth or euphoria to be found. We're hanging out just below 110,000 today as time of recording. And, you know, if you look above the hood or below the hood, there's just, everything seems to be lining up here. So, you know, it's debatable if Bitcoin will continue to follow commodity cycles. It's not debatable that in the past it has, where when there's a huge increase in liquidity in the global system, the spot price rises significantly higher than the all-in cost to mine one Bitcoin. Once that liquidity tide turns, that spot price contracts down to that cost to mine. If you think of it kind of like foreign exchange markets, you know, arbitrage opportunities get traded away within milliseconds. This has typically taken about a year for those two different costs to contract just because of the physical limitations of setting up mining. Now, if that continues into the future is up for debate. I think that the stablecoin bill and a Bitcoin Reserve Act are the two real pieces that could potentially shift us to follow more of a credit-based cycle. I say all of this to mention that Bitcoin spot price and the average estimate to mine Bitcoin, there's really only like a 10% spread right now. In the past, at past cycle peaks, the spot price was, the most recent cycle, 3.5x the cost to mine a Bitcoin.
Wow.
And in 2017, it was 6x. So, I mean, these numbers are essentially touching each other. I think there's a few reasons to point to that. But that looks like a very strong foundation. You look anywhere else, the standard deviations away the prices from the short-term hurdle cost basis, there's no signs there. Usually that has to be 3 to 4 standard deviations above to really kick off a multi-year bear market. You know, and you could go on and on. Everyone's favorite moving averages that have done a pretty good job when they intersect of pinning tops. I don't know if this is going to be relevant in the future, but these are nowhere close to intersecting today. So that's, you know, under the hood. You look above the hood. We have a stablecoin bill that looks like it's on the verge of passing. I think that the stablecoin market could go from 250 billion to, you could 10x in, 5 years after that bill. And a dollar being used in stable coins is much closer to saving in Bitcoin than a dollar sitting in a checking account. And then you look at the states, you know, it sounds like Texas is one signature away from a Reserve Act. We've had a couple, but Texas's economy on its own is a top 10 if it was its own country, right? That'd be a huge step. You look at treasury market dysfunction. You look at Japan's yields blowing out. The list goes on and on. Everything seems to be lining up. I'd love to see what Trey said. I'd love to see a 30 to 40% pop consolidate for 5-6 months. 30 to 40% pop consolidate 5 to 6 months. If we don't get that strategic reserve bill, though, I do expect an eventual nasty bear market, not because the Bitcoin thesis changed, but just because it had performed so well. But that, you know, that Reserve Act of the U.S. government accumulating 1 million Bitcoin over 5 years, that could really kick off the digital gold rush in a different way. Every government, every corporation would have to react. And that constant bid in the market, you could see, you know, what gold did when a gold ETF first came out, went on like an 8 to 10 year gradual bull run. You could see something like that. And then, you know, on the other end of it, Bitcoin then would follow more of like a credit-based cycle as opposed to a commodity-based cycle. But, you know, all that to say, the stars are lining up, and I'll throw it back over to Trey if he has any thoughts.
Today's episode of Business Bitcoinization is proudly brought to you by Velus Commerce, where the future of business technology meets Bitcoin. As we journey through the era of Bitcoin and its transformational impact on businesses, there's one name that stands out: Velus Commerce. Whether you're looking to build a cutting-edge website, a seamless mobile app, or custom software, Velus is your go-to team. They've been diving deep into the world of Bitcoin since 2014, making them one of the most experienced groups for integrating Bitcoin and Lightning payments into a variety of digital platforms. But here's what truly sets them apart. Velus Commerce doesn't just build. They bring a wealth of knowledge to ensure your project's success from day one. Their team understands the nuances of Bitcoin, ensuring that your business stays ahead of the curve. And for all business Bitcoinization listeners out there, Velus Commerce is offering a free consultation to kickstart your project the right way. So if you're ready to future-proof your business in the coming age of hyper-Bitcoinization, head over to veluscommerce.com or reach out on Twitter at veluscommerce. Let's make sure your business thrives in the Bitcoin era. If you are hit by a bus right now, could your family access your Bitcoin? When's the right time to stop hodling and use Bitcoin to impact your family's lives, not just yours? What if Bitcoin doesn't reach the value you expect, or it takes longer to reach that value? Do you have a plan? Do you have the proper trust structure to avoid probate, maintain your privacy, and minimize taxes? Do you want to avoid taxes to stack more sats or leverage your stack without selling? Should you add Bitcoin to your business's balance sheet? Are you truly confident in your self-custody setup? If any of those questions made you stop and think, you probably realize that simply buying and holding Bitcoin is not a complete financial plan. That's where Strong Wealth comes in. Orange-pilled advisors blending traditional financial planning with deep Bitcoin expertise, giving you the best of both worlds, so you can sleep peacefully knowing you're making the right moves for your family no matter what happens. Schedule a free call at strongwealth.net. That's strongwealth.net. Strong Wealth, wealth management for Bitcoiners by Bitcoiners. And let me ask you real quick. Do you think that in the next year or two, the United States is actually going to begin working towards that accumulation of 1 million Bitcoin?
I'm optimistic, but I actually think it'd be more likely if it were to happen in Trump's term. More so 27, 28. I don't know if it's going to be a focus before the midterms. Now, I know that's not Trump's decision, right? This could go through ideally, this goes through the House and Senate. That's where we want to see this bill passed. It's up for debate on if this is the way I look at it. The stablecoin bill absolutely has to happen first. The U.S. is in an interesting spot with this Bitcoin Reserve Act because we've already acknowledged that Bitcoin has a role as a reserve asset. If we announce that prior to finding more demand for our treasuries, then we're increasing the chances of a significant treasury market dysfunction. Passing the stablecoin bill first allows some time for that demand of all that stablecoin growth and all of those stablecoin issuers to then need to acquire. Now, it's on the short end of the yield curve, but it's still better than nothing, of course. The major problems are on the long end of the curve, but having that stablecoin bill then I think opens the door to, okay, yeah, this Bitcoin Reserve Act is inevitable. The sooner we do it, the better. It just has to come after we find more buyers for our treasuries, right? So it's hard for me to say if it's going to happen. Of course, I would like it to. If I had to guess, I don't think it happens by the end of 2026. And that's why I do think we'll have an eventual bear market, even if it doesn't time up with everyone's typical expectations. Instead of maybe a year and a half after the halving, we're leaving quantitative tightening right now, right? The liquidity cycle could just start expanding now. So, we could have this bear market, but maybe it's on a different timeline than everyone expects.
Yeah, we've seen that liquidity piece in the form of M2 expanding, and there's a lot of controversy as to whether or not that is an accurate view of money supply and all of that. I mean, my personal opinion is that it's certainly correlated with the actual expansion of the money supply, or it's a positive force toward that. There may be some other offsetting forces that would negate a shift upward in M2 in terms of like actual liquidity in the system and actual like money supply across the whole world. But I think we're seeing this strong correlation between that metric and the Bitcoin price, almost to an uncanny thing here recently. So that's going to be fun to watch to see how that continues to play out. Joe, you're talking about the Bitcoin Act, which is an act of Congress. That is certainly, I think I agree with you. If that happens at all, it's going to be a couple of years before they get to that. But what about the executive order, about, you know, budget neutral ways of acquiring Bitcoin and that kind of thing? I mean, aren't you more bullish on that, at least in the short term? And then my second question to you, or to you too, Josh, is I'm trying to wrap my head around, like, okay, we have this stablecoin bill. People seem to think, oh, that's super bullish for Bitcoin and I don't know, maybe other assets as well. What's the impetus there? Is it really just saying, oh, there's more demand for treasuries, which would lower rates, which would provide more liquidity in the system, and therefore it's bullish for assets? Or like, what's the causal mechanism there?
Sure. So one point was the one I made earlier, that a dollar sitting in stablecoins, the psychological leap has already taken place that asset is residing on a public blockchain as opposed to a centralized ledger, like at a bank. That's one step. I think it's more so legitimizing quote unquote digital assets for people that haven't quite understood just how unique Bitcoin is in this whole picture. They may understand Bitcoin's the biggest, but they would look at this as, you know, just digital assets being legitimized in general. And I think there would be a flood of capital coming into the space. That's where I stand on it. You know, I think that stable coins, you know, if you love them or hate them, I see the use case for them. They, of course, don't protect your purchasing power, but I see.
Why are people excited about JP Morgan and Bank of America or whoever, Wells Fargo, issuing a stable coin? Like, isn't that their whole reason for being right now and always, is to issue the stable coin that is the US dollar?
Well, I think it's more about...
I mean, don't they already do that, I guess?
Yeah, like,
what's the advantage of a JP Morgan stable coin? I don't get this.
I think what's happening here is that control of the euro dollar market will come back onshore. I think of it in terms of the medium to long term. The Fed's policy hadn't really impacted the euro dollar market to the degree that they wanted to. And if they have control over, with this act, if they have control over the stablecoin market, that's where they really see stablecoins dominating the euro dollar market, which of course is this monster that probably doesn't get addressed or talked about enough. So I think that's one factor. And this puts a dollar denominated asset in the pocket of anyone on the globe with a phone.
I don't quite know why the United States would necessarily want the larger banks to have the ability to create their own stablecoin. I could see the benefit for the banks and, you know, making sure that they have more people using their stablecoin, maybe giving them better terms and things like that if they do that. That actually helps us transition to this next part of the conversation, which is about JP Morgan allowing its customers, its clientele, to purchase Bitcoin, even while Jamie Dimon continues to essentially protest. And I think that's an interesting place where a big bank is moving. Jamie Dimon, who's leading the bank, doesn't like it, and yet he's still bending the knee to Bitcoin. And I think it's not a major piece of news right now, but I think looking back, this type of stuff is much more signal than a lot of people may think it is in the moment. Trey, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, everybody bends a knee to Bitcoin eventually. Jamie Dimon's knee is about halfway to the ground. He'll get there eventually. I think, like, look, if he was actually opposed to it in any meaningful way, it wouldn't be happening. But he can read the writing on the wall to say, like, look, I may not like it, but I can't be opposed to it because that is the way that things are going. And, you know, to some degree, like, yes, JP Morgan is probably one of the most powerful institutions on the planet, but there is still some ball game to be played between them and the other larger commercial banks and the government. And it's very clear that the government, the federal government at least, is very bullish on this sector of crypto and Bitcoin. And so, you know, that politicking has to happen. Mm-hmm. if it were the other way around and Kamala Harris was in office and none of these tailwinds coming from the political direction were happening, like we still would be seeing growth in stablecoins and Tether. Who knows, maybe the price of Bitcoin would be even higher just because it's, you know, kind of a different way of hedging your risk, you know, or something like that. But you probably wouldn't see Jamie Dimon and, you know, the and JP Morgan and these other large commercial banks being so gung-ho on putting a stablecoin piece together. Again, like I still don't see how this actually works out from like a technical perspective. You know, the way that I think about a stablecoin is very similar to a euro dollar, which means like by definition, it's outside of the control of the US. Right. Like if it's inside the control of the US, then it's not a euro dollar. Issuing a stable coin is like issuing this kind of phantom token that's backed by treasuries. There's still some control that you have over that because you can cut off access to these USTs. But if you're looking for granular control, which I think they would, on how people are actually spending those dollars, well, now all of a sudden you're bifurcating the liquidity for those individual tokens in a way that is not really beneficial for supporting USD. So like, again, I'm an open mind here in terms of like how this is actually going to work out. I just don't really see how we connect the dots from all this talk about stablecoins and banks being involved to like what actually happens on the ground as this plays out.
Are euro dollars backed by treasuries though? It's probably not like a blanket statement either way, but my understanding is that it's a little bit more amorphous than that.
It is. Yeah. It's backed by credit. Treasuries are one form of credit. The governments with that the international banks are issuing euro dollars in have treasuries as part of their reserves. So like there is this, you know, connectivity into the treasury market across the globe. I mean, that's just, it is the world global reserve asset. You know, it's more about like, okay, the banks that are international, and Joe, feel free to jump in here if I'm like, you know, stating this in a way that's not making sense, is they're issuing credit among one another. They're denominating that credit in dollars, which means that they have to somehow get those dollars in order to satisfy those debts. And one way of doing that is holding treasuries, which pay coupons in dollars and can be sold for dollars as and when they need to. So I think like that's my understanding of how all that dark market financing actually works. But you're right. Like it's very complex.
Yeah. I look at it as just dollar denominated debt that comes into existence from outside the Fed's purview at a certain banking institution. And they likely do hold US treasuries, but them issuing that new debt does not create new US treasuries. So it's
so it adds leverage to the system.
It adds leverage to the system. And those are now dollars where the Fed's monetary policy does not impact them as much as they would have liked. Now, there's been some big shifts like LIBOR to SOFR that, you know, I don't think really get talked about enough in the last few years. But that's probably a deeper path than we're going here today. But back to Jamie Dimon really quick. Two phrases that have been said many times prior to me saying this, right? Watch what they do, not what they say. A and B, any way that Wall Street sees significant demand and that they can make significant fees, they're going to jump in. Now, I think this jawboning is a little silly. I actually remember a year ago, Jamie actually made some relatively positive comments about Bitcoin. I don't remember exactly what it was, but I remember, you know, probably myself included, but everyone kind of overreacted to, is this a pivot? Like, just out of curiosity, I think I got asked that on a different podcast I was on. But at the end of the day, he probably looks at this as treasury market dysfunction would be really bad for business. The Fed and Scott Bessent already have a hard enough time right now to avoid treasury market dysfunction. Bitcoin, to people like us, is the ultimate reserve asset. Now, the people Jamie Dimon rubs elbows with probably not quite there, but they are looking at Bitcoin as a reserve asset to take into consideration. So I think he's really, if there's any more explanation to this other than he's just doing more of the same, I'd probably think it's something like that, where they want to make fees, but they don't want to encourage people to look into Bitcoin who haven't already done so.
Well, yeah. And just beyond that, right? Like, they're responding to client demand. They have private client people on the JP Morgan side, and probably plenty of retail customers on the Chase side who want Bitcoin exposure. They know that they could get that exposure very easily through, you know, their banking relationships, whether that's on the retail side or on the private bank side. And if you don't offer something that is significantly demanded by your clients that they're telling you they want, they will go seek it elsewhere, which risks them losing business to some other banking institution that will offer the ability for them to buy and sell Bitcoin right next to their checking account, or, you know, within the auspices of their private wealth management services. So, you know, and it's not like this is the very first foray that JP Morgan has had into Bitcoin. Like, I think they have already offered some types of like limited exposure to certain pockets of their client base on the private bank side or high net worth side and that kind of thing. It's just now it's just recognizing we have to continue down this path in order to continue to compete for deposits and for the fees that Joe is talking about.
It'll be interesting to see what the custody options are for the Bitcoin that clients do purchase. I guess following the trend of organizations moving to Bitcoin, another relevant article this week is Ledin moving to basically being a Bitcoin-only company, not doing any lending connected to altcoins, but just going Bitcoin-only. I know, Trey, you've just been talking, but you coming from Unchained, you're probably familiar with the differences between, or at least the benefits of Bitcoin-only when it comes to lending. Maybe you can provide some thoughts here. Is the whole world moving towards Bitcoin and Bitcoin only?
Yes, moving towards. I mean, we're not there yet. Unchained used to offer Ethereum-backed loans way back in the day and very smartly jettisoned that business for various reasons. The first is that, you know, supporting another token out there and actually doing it in a way that brings people close to their collateral, which is what Unchained is founded on and has always prided ourselves on offering to the market, is much more difficult with anything outside of Bitcoin. There's, you know, multisig is not built into Ethereum at the protocol level like it is in Bitcoin. You've got all of this other infrastructure that you have to maintain in order to maintain these kind of dual systems here. And by the way, the Ethereum Foundation and Ethereum, generally speaking, changes the rules of the game on whatever whim they have. And there's hard forks you have to contend with and all this stuff. It's just an operational nightmare to be able to do that, even if you're not philosophically opposed to going after like that type of a market and dealing with those types of assets. The other thing is that, you know, the loan book, when we supported that, was 95% Bitcoin versus 5% Ethereum. So it's just a time suck and a resource suck to support something that is so small relative to the overall volume of the loan book. So, you know, those are the main reasons that was jettisoned. And I think the company over time morphed into a very Bitcoin focused from a philosophical standpoint and understanding like that is where the signal is. That's where we should be focused. And that's where the majority of the value is going to be. And then just, you know, secondarily, like Ledin is responding to the market in a similar type of way. I don't know what their operational setup is looking like. I don't know how much they build in-house relative to you know, the way that Unchained approaches things, which we like to build and control as much of our infrastructure as possible so that we're not reliant on external companies who may go bankrupt and then disrupt our products and services, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't know what that looks like for Ledin, but I imagine that their demand was probably waning for Ethereum if it ever was substantial at all. And by the way, like, look at the Ethereum versus Bitcoin chart. It just continues to bleed out, as you would expect from any type of like commodity token out there that is really has no, there's no reason to hold Ethereum for any length of time other than using it as part of that ecosystem. If you find value in the ecosystem at all, you only need to hold the Ethereum for enough time to actually use that functionality. And so if you take that view, which the market is, then there's no reason to hold onto those tokens. You'd rather hold onto Bitcoin and then just maybe trade it for Ethereum whenever you need to use it. I don't personally think there's much utility over there, right? So like, I would never touch it, but you know, some people do. And so I think the market is responding to people's understanding of that.
Business owners, unlock the benefits Bitcoin has to offer your business with a Bitcoin for Business Quick Start Guide. This 27-page guide highlights the 6 ways you can grow your business with Bitcoin. Check it out in the show notes. And Joe, I'd like to hear your thoughts on this as well. Along with, do any of your clients, are they ever interested in Bitcoin-backed loans, or does that ever come up in conversation as you're working with individuals or businesses?
Yeah, not too much to add to what Trace said, other than, you know, I can't even count the number of times that you hear Bitcoin is pristine collateral. You know, it's like you're not even seeking this phrase out, but it's going to find you several times a day, usually. I've never heard anyone say Ethereum is pristine collateral, so or anything even relatively close to that. So I think, you know, I would echo Trey's comments and thoughts. And yeah, I mean, Bitcoin is being used as collateral is something that I've tried to more so medium to long term put in the minds of my clients. That's where I think a lot of this is heading, as just one phase of Bitcoin's evolution and adoption for the, you know, very obvious reasons, but I'd say it's starting to pique their interest more. You know, I think we're right around the corner from getting high single digit interest rates, which will be a big deal. And, you know, I think Bitcoin being used as collateral is going to continue to increase naturally. I think it's really, you know, coming of age moment, full blown adoption moment for that will be once we've gone 5 to 6 years with no drawdowns that are roughly over 50%. Because in the past, of course, every 4 years, there's been anywhere from 78 to 95% drawdowns, right? That's really the only thing holding up Bitcoin being used as collateral more freely. Because technically, as the asset and the network is designed, it's the best collateral on the planet. It's just you have to have that, you have to manage that risk, and you're adding some stress and some risks into the game. And of course, rehypothecation in the past has given Bitcoin its collateral black eyes when it's really just those centralized business models that were flawed. So
I don't know that volatility is really as much of a barrier as people think that it is. I think like banks and traditional financial institutions who are in like the repo market or the traditional like lending market, they understand haircuts and how to manage that volatility. And, you know, if you have a more volatile asset, you're going to have a larger haircut on some type of like overnight loan or something, mm-hmm. right? Like we see this in the repo market all the time. I think it's more about clearing the roadblocks for them to actually play in this space and come in with some capital that they can provide there. I don't think that the volatility is necessarily going to keep people from entering the market. It's more about understanding that one, their customers have this asset on their balance sheet and that they would want to borrow against it. And two, like having the compliance or the regulatory environment conducive to them actually playing in the space.
From more of an institutional lens, I definitely agree. I was more so under the mindset of the type of clients I work with and more so just picturing people trying to acquire a home using Bitcoin as collateral. But yeah, solid points, Trey.
Well, with that, let's go ahead and finish up. And Joe, you were just talking about clients, so maybe you can give people a quick way to follow up and learn more about you and what you're doing, as well as I'd like to take a quick second for you guys to share any hot takes or predictions for the Bitcoin conference that, once again, has not yet happened, but will have happened by the time this airs.
Yeah, sure. So I'm on X pretty much every day, but I don't have a presence on there. I just use it as a news feed. you know, I like it being that unbiased source of information to help me view my, to shape my views of the world. That's just me. You know, there's days I wish that 10 years ago I had made a different decision there, but overall I'm pretty happy with it. You could certainly reach out to me on LinkedIn or on my website as well. It's linkster.com, LYNCSTER.com. Prediction for the Bitcoin conference. I feel like this is kind of a relatively easy prediction, but I think one more Bitcoin treasury company will be announced over the course of the time. Now, I actually don't think during the Bitcoin conference is a good time to make big announcements, just because such a large part of the Bitcoin movement is not sitting at their computer like they typically do, looking at the feeds. They're either in a conference hall or trying to pick themselves up together from the previous night or anywhere in between. But I'll go with that prediction. I think there will be one more of these. As Trey, I heard you previously reference to them as essentially Bitcoin hedge funds. I think that's the appropriate way to look at them. I think one more of these will pop up.
I think the question is how many more, not will there be one more. I can't imagine. It's going to be crazy with all these announcements. Trey, how about you?
Yeah. One quick note there, if you don't mind, Trey, just before you get in. I hear a lot of talk that there's room for 2-3 dozen of these companies. I don't have that view. I think if you look back 10 years from now, I think there could be room for 5 to 10 big winners in the US market. I think there should be a couple of these vehicles in each major equity market. Japan, they have Metaplanet, London, Europe, China, Hong Kong. It makes sense for them to each have a few of these. But at the end of the day, the more Bitcoin you have, the better you are at the playbook, the more volatility you have, the more optionality you have in terms of capital raising. So I can see why an individual would want to diversify a little bit and invest into 2 or 3 or 4 of these companies. But why would you buy the 15th largest copycat? I don't see that story there. But what I hope to see is kind of this playing out with 3 tiers, really. You'll have that top tier of 5 to 10 big winners, as long as they manage their risk and greed doesn't get the best of them. Then you'll have another tier where they dip into the capital markets, but that's not their primary order of business, is the Bitcoin related KPIs of yield per share, et cetera, or Bitcoin per fully diluted share and Bitcoin yield, et cetera. And then you'll have the third tier, which I don't see enough talk about, of just good old fashioned Bitcoin adoption by corporations. I would love the next 2 announcements to be S&P 500 companies that just say we're putting 5% of our liquid assets into Bitcoin. And we're just going to evaluate from here on how that goes and if we want to accumulate more or not. Because you just think about how many companies there are, how much capital there is not in Bitcoin. We definitely don't want this narrative that you either are a strategy copycat or you're sitting on the sidelines. And that's kind of that third tier. And it'll be really fascinating to watch this play out. Communication is going to be so crucial for these companies trying to diversify themselves. But it's hard to keep your eyes off of at the same time.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, Joe. I think, liquidity begets liquidity, and that's true in the capital markets, just as it is in money, generally speaking. And so you're right. Like, why would you buy the 15th largest thing in the US market when you could just buy like the top 1 or 2, which is going to offer you a lot more liquidity, a deeper options market? Like, if that's what you're going for, you can get all of that by just buying strategy. I think it makes sense that there are other ones popping up in other markets that are cordoned off from the ability to get access to strategy or to some of the other players in different markets. So yeah, you've got Metaplanet in Japan, you've got something new, it sounds like, coming up in Hong Kong. I'm aware of something going on in Brazil. And so you'll see those things get access to capital, but how can you have like a whole bunch of these things? I also think it's completely insane to think that any one of these is going to get to 5 million Bitcoin, like zero chance. So I will take that. I mean, I don't know what you think about that, Joe and Josh, but like, I just do not see that happening. The price cannot withstand that type of bidding. It just can't. So
yeah,
we'll go way higher before any of that happens.
I haven't spent too much time thinking about that, but I hope you're right. One quick Bitcoin treasury company prediction before we hand it back to Trey for his Bitcoin conference prediction. This is an if-then prediction. So if we do not get the Bitcoin Act through Congress by, you know, the next 12 to 18 months from now, let's just call it end of 2026. If we do not get that, then we do get a large bear market, significant drawdown. One or two of these Bitcoin treasury companies, when you're deep into that bear market, they will be selling Bitcoin to buy back their shares. Because last bear market, Strategy was trading at a discount to its Bitcoin, essentially its MNAV. And there's no reason why that wouldn't happen again. And this may not be one of these current companies. The current ones are all led by hardcore Bitcoiners. They're relatively early to this, early-ish, depending on how, you know, the next 18 months plays out. It may be Bitcoin treasury companies that don't exist yet that I'm referring to, that are talking about this now, or they're going to launch like at the worst possible time. You know, later on this year or next year. So that's just like a dynamic that wouldn't surprise me. And it'd be a huge uproar within Bitcoin talking circles. And, you know, the company would simply say, we have an obligation to our shareholders. If the company is small enough too, you have to worry about shareholder activism, where if it's trading at a discount, all it takes is a few large equity holders to step in and say, you know, they need to sell their Bitcoin to purchase their shares. So it's just kind of introducing some fun topics to talk about, but also potentially in a bear market, some distractions to, you know, the bigger picture and message of Bitcoin. But I wish them all well. It's fascinating to watch. You know, Metaplanet and, you know, Dylan are putting on a clinic. I don't know if you guys saw the short squeeze that just happened there. I just couldn't help but laugh that Metaplanet was the most shorted stock in Japan. When we're talking about how incredible under the hood and above the hood Bitcoin looks right now, never a dull moment.
A lot of education just happened.
You're totally right that, like, I think some of these companies for sure will be selling Bitcoin to buy back their stock when they're trading at a discount. It makes financial sense. Like, why wouldn't you do that? I guess I'd have to think a little bit more about like how the math actually works on that. But are you producing a positive Bitcoin yield by doing that? You know, if that's your measurement stick, I think you might be right. So like they could still hit their KPIs by just responding to that market, and you're trading the premium versus discount. This goes back to some warnings that I've laid out there, you know, in previous episodes and that kind of thing, which is just if you're buying these companies, be very aware of the premium that you're paying. Okay, I know we want to wrap this up. So, Bitcoin conference, two predictions. The first one is that I'm playing in the Bitcoin Golf Championship on Monday. We're going deep. Myself and my partner, we're going deep. We're going to finish top five. I don't even know how many teams there are. I imagine there's 144 players, so 72 teams or something. But we're going deep. I'm getting one of those prizes. That's prediction number one. Prediction number two, which is gonna sound terrible coming from me, who's you know, always bullish, but I think we've seen the top of this little run that we're gonna correct through next week and the next few weeks. That's gonna kind of start with the Bitcoin conference. It's amazing that we're going into this conference at all-time highs. But I don't think that we're going to be lucky enough to see the price ripping into 125,000 during the conference. I don't think it's ever happened in the past where we've had like a raging bull run going during the conference week. So that's my prediction that we're going to see some chop here.
Real quick question. Do you think that we're going to go down to Josh Mann's prediction of 84K?
I think it's entirely possible. Right? Like if I look at the price structure, going down to 84K would kind of, you know, be the right shoulder of a massive inverted head and shoulders type of pattern, right? Where you're just going down, you're testing that level of support that we formed in the, call it 74 to 86 range. I'm looking at the price chart over here between March and, you know, middle of April. It would be perfectly logical for that to be the level that gets tested before finally being able to break out into some like real hardcore blue sky territory. So, will it get there? I don't know, man. Like there is so much of a bid under this market that like it might try to go there. But as I was kind of alluding to earlier, I think probably my base case is that we correct between here and get down maybe into the mid to low 90s at the at the lowest. And then we'll have that swooshing move up into the 125 and then 150 type range pretty quickly. Mm-hmm.
Well, so my predictions, they may not be that crazy, but I think that JD Vance will be underwhelming. I think that security, maybe not as bad as last year, but it will be overwhelming, at least for that day. And I think that by the end of the conference, everyone's going to be tired of hearing the word Nakamoto. So call me crazy for those three predictions, but I think that's probably going to be the case. All right. Well, we'll see. Judge us on these predictions for those of you listening right now. And guys, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, guys. Thanks. Enjoyed it.
Yeah. Great talking with you guys.
Well, friends, it's a wrap. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Bitcoin Playbook. If you want to reach out to either me, Trey, or Joe, you can find those links down in the show notes. And be sure to keep up with what Trey and Joe are doing. Also, let us know how we did on our predictions. As always, keep building, keep growing. Until next time, keep living and leading well.